It's Thursday, July 3rd, 2025, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. And here we are, July 3rd, one day before the anniversary of our country, the founding of our country. Not really the founding. 1776, July 4th, more of a statement of intent. I always found it weird that the 4th of July was the founding of the country, not a country, quite a while, had to win a war. Then the Articles of a Confederation. I would pay money for Trump to give a no one ever talks about and then say the Articles of a Confederation, because they really don't. Was it shameful? Was it failure to launch? I'm going to write historical fiction, maybe even a musical about the Articles of Confederation. It will be poorly, poorly attended. Remember the 1619 Project, which started with the rhetorical hook? What if I told you 1619 should be considered the founding of the country? My answer is I dismiss it. It's not a good argument. And so I did, but there was a lot of consternation involved. So the founding of the country should probably be when there was a country. There was a constitution, 1787. I'm into that. How can you have a country that was founded before there were citizens? When were the first citizens? Had to happen after the constitution. Then Washington sworn in, 1789. Before that, Congress is seated April 1789. Logically, and I also looked it up, actually, factually, historically, 1788, there were elections for these senators, actually not senators, for these representatives. Direct election of the Senate didn't come till later. So it should be 1788, but it's not. It's 1776. And so we are one year before the sestercentennial. This can be considered the pre-sestercentennial. Maybe that would mean July 3rd of next year. Maybe it just means that July 4th of this year is the anti-sestercentennial. I certainly hope so. You know, and I am assuming that we're going to get to the sestercentennial, 250. You know, most things that get to 249 do get to 250. Have you ever seen the actuarial tables? They tell you when most people die, but then they also acknowledge, look, most people don't live to 103. But if you live to 102, you got a fair shot of living to 103. If you're an entity that lives to 249, I think you're going to make it to 250. It's not always true, like the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, the Union of Lublin, founded in 1569, ended in 1795. That would be 226 years. So 225 years in, they were probably, you know, extremely excited to celebrate their Kwaski bicentennial. Yes, their Kwaski bicentennial didn't happen for the Polish-Lithuanians, sadly. Hashtag sad Polish Lithuanians. And then there are, you know, the Baltimore News American. It lasted 213 years. 212 years in, they were like, we're doing great. We got the jumble. There's the city in Scotland of Inverary. It's a long way to Inverary, and it was a long way to this in the top of the show, but it was raised to a royal burg in 1742. It was abolished in 1975. So, you know, that's a good 233-year run in 232. I don't know what they were thinking. And then you have Adwaita, the Aldabra giant tortoise from the Alipore Zoo in India, lived to be 255 years. Didn't look a day over 254, but was a year over 254, but then died. These are some thoughts, the thoughts that come to a man as he contemplates his nation's poorly defined sestercentennial. On the show today, I give you a full show interview. It is with two giants of the field. One is Jerry Springer and the other is Leon Neyfakh. Leon did a podcast about Jerry Springer. Leon's podcasts are always good. This is about his time in government. This first part is about his time in government. Plus, there were some scandals. Please sit back and enjoy Final Thoughts, Jerry Springer and the host, Leon Neyfakh. When you think of Jerry Springer, you probably think about all the things he wanted you to think about with his show. You thought about DNA tests and Steve and Chance and Final Thoughts and people going crazy and chairs being thrown and pervs, yokels, hicks, and weirdos. Well, That is not how Jerry Springer thought of himself. After listening to Leon Neyfakh's new series, Final Thoughts, about Jerry Springer, an Audible original, I think we're calling it podcasts now, I came to the conclusion that Springer wasn't a tortured soul at odds with his public persona in a way that tore him apart. But Jerry saw the Jerry of TV and the real life Jerry as two different, distinct entities. And getting to know that second non-public Jerry entity, the political entity, was really interesting. Of course it was, because that's what Leon Neyfakh does. A really interesting podcast. Welcome back to The Gist, Leon.
Thanks, Mike.
Why Jerry? Of all the possible topics.
Well, we, what's the expression? Made our bones?
Mm-hmm.
Do you make your bones?
You do make bones. I mean, I don't know if that's the expression you're going for, but that is an expression.
Okay, we made our bones doing political history with Slow Burn and then Fiasco. And then we've strayed from that on a few projects, right? We did the Michael Jackson show. More recently, we did two seasons of a business show called Backfired. One was about the vaping industry. The other was about the history of ADHD. And we have been meaning to sort of try to find a political show that could also be one of the other things we like to do. So not a straight politics series, but something that overlaps with some other world. And so Jerry Springer presented this incredible opportunity to both tell a story about American politics and recent history, which is very much our sweet spot, but sort of do it on a novel stage, because so much of the Jerry Springer show takes place in the world of daytime television, the 1990s entertainment industry. And so it was both a serious story, but it was also one that seemed like it would be a lot of fun to make.
I think most people do know that Jerry Springer had a history in politics, mayor of Cincinnati, maybe an asterisk there, given how Cincinnati decides on who the mayor was.
Oh, but what come was the consensus? Really asterisk because
you
of that?
Me. You tell me. You tell me. I mean, was he elected by the majority of the people of Cincinnati?
No, no, no. You're right. You're right. He did become mayor.
Yep.
It's true. The system in Cincinnati does make
the
mayor.
It doesn't go to the eighth caller, but.
Fine.
What's the consensus about how talented a politician was he?
Those who remember him on the local stage in Cincinnati in the early 70s and who watched him, you know, over the course of a decade, roughly, a little longer, they described him to us in interviews that we did, you know, in Cincinnati. A lot of these guys are still around, still working in Democratic politics. We heard from more than one person that, you know, the only figure they could compare him to was Bill Clinton, that he had such an ability to connect with a crowd, to connect with an individual. For whatever reason, the picture of young Jerry Springer politicking in my mind takes place in a bowling alley, because apparently this was a thing in America, early morning women's bowling leagues. Are you aware of this?
Only from your show.
Okay. So there was a lot more. I wanted to include a lot more about this, but I was.
Oh, really? You know a
vetoed.
Lot about the institution of early. Go ahead.
I don't know enough. No, I was warned off of it. I said we gotta really dive into this, and my team wisely advised me to move on. But yeah, he would visit these bowling alleys in the morning when these moms were out playing out bowling, and he would just charm them, and they all thought of him as. You know, and I'm basing this, you know, on the testimony of Jerry's friend, you know, a guy who was there with him in the bowling alley and who drove him around. But they all treated him like he was their son, which came in handy when, you know, maybe you'll get to this, but Jerry's tenure as a local politician in Cincinnati was not without speed bumps, which people were willing to forgive him for in the end, because
speed bumps
so,
with a paper trail and checks written out to prostitutes.
But his charisma, to your question, his charisma, his personal magnetism was so great that he prevailed even over that.
So at the time, I guess people in the 90s would reach for Bill Clinton if you're trying to compliment a politician of great personal charm. But Bobby Kennedy was the figure in Springer's own mind who he always aspired to, right?
There's an episode that begins with Jerry Springer. I believe it's when he's running for Congress in Ohio. This was before he became a city councilman in Cincinnati. He ran and lost a congressional race. I think he was like 26 at the time or something like that. he just sounds exactly like RFK. Like, he's clearly doing an RFK impression. And it's quite jarring to hear that and then kind of flip the channel to, I had sex with my stepbrother and I'm not sorry.
Right. And the DNA says the father is yours.
I did want to... Mike, I do apologize. The DNA thing.
That's
a common misconception.
It
was a Springer thing.
And the chair thing is a Geraldo thing, right?
That's right. That's right. If you're going to give him the asterisk for the Cincinnati thing,
no
I will
problem.
Clarify. No
Do you
DNA
know
test
if he,
on Jerry Springer.
If he looked at Maury's DNA innovation and shook his fist and said, "Oh, why don't we think of this? You guys are slipping."
I don't know. It's a great question. I'm sure they did. I mean, it clearly worked.
So but it
seems like they get a lot of credit for it anyway, despite having not done it.
Right. So you mentioned, it's the Mandela effect. You mentioned all the women who were taken by him in these bowling leagues. They also would routinely say, and you quote a guy, you find a body man named Jon Snow, of all things.
That's the guy I was referring to before, the friend, yeah.
Yeah. So Jon Snow, who in this case does know something, says that, you know, these women used to always come up to him and they'd clamor around him and they were enamored by him and they would always tell themselves, "Oh, he went to high school with my brother-in-law yeah. here in Cincinnati. No, he went to high school with my sister." He's of course, I mean, just listen to his accent. He's of course from Queens. Yeah. This tells me something about his personal magnetism.
That he was able to prevail over his Queens accent to yeah.
That they actually thought he was a Cincinnatian.
That's right. Yeah. No, it was like not a major issue at all. I assumed that he would be, you know, tarred as a carpetbagger. But I think he kind of neutralized it without much effort. I got the impression.
Take me inside the politics of Cincinnati at the time, and what were Springer's politics and how did they map onto each other?
So Springer's sort of first foray into politics was around the issue of lowering the voting age. He had not fought in Vietnam, but he was, I think, offended by the idea, like a lot of people, that one could be sent to a war that you had no role in bringing about, and you can't even vote to stop it if you wanted to. And so he was advocating for a change to the Ohio law. Ultimately, he ended up testifying in Congress about a federal law, which of course became the 26th Amendment. So he was like right out of the gate, he was pretty unapologetically progressive. He was anti-war. He didn't sort of talk out of both sides of his mouth on that issue. He was entering a city which was quite conservative. Like, its political establishment was quite conservative. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the way he was described to us, he was A, younger than them. He was a sort of an energetic Kennedy-style Democrat. And also he had a sort of feel for spectacle and media attention that they lacked. And so he sort of ran circles around this old guard and was seen as kind of a threat, I think, to Cincinnati, as sort of a conservative town, at least in terms of City Hall. And, you know, I think he was dangerous to that establishment because he could both speak to the countercultural hippies about the war, but he could also talk to blue collar workers and they would believe him. They wouldn't feel like he was talking down to them or condescending to them or being inauthentic. And I think that was a pretty rare talent.
So his sense of spectacle or his ability to get attention in the early days when he was just a politician and aspiring to be a politician, maybe aspiring to higher office, did we see signs of the spectacle of veering into the circus ringmaster, or was it tawdry, or was it more effective communication in a way that was cutting edge and exciting?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't say it was tawdry. No, he was, you know, a good example is there was a beloved building, like a Cincinnati landmark that was, I believe it was, forgive me anyone who's listening from Cincinnati, but I believe it was the train station. It was under threat of being torn down, and Jerry advocated against it, and as part of that, wrote and recorded a folk song that got him a bunch of press, and that was sort of like an unexpected way to drive attention to the issue.
They built her back in 33 when the railroad man was king. Depression-bound folks came to town, forever wandering. There was depots by the dozen in the cities large and small, but God knows Union Terminal was the grandest of them all. Save the Union Terminal from the wrecking ball and chain. Life without them railroad blues would never be the same. Save the Union Terminal.
Another time he spent the night in the local jail so that he could speak the next day about the conditions in it that he felt were in need of upgrades.
And they have a bucket there. They have to go to the bathroom. And they have straw mattresses.
There was a big campaign that he led the way on to take the private bus company in town that everyone was unhappy with and have the city buy it and take it public. And that effort was successful, and you know, I think the day the first bus was to touch off from the starting line, he commandeered it and drove it around the town. Just kind of dumb and not tawdry, certainly, but just like kind of goofy. Everything, you know, the thing people always say about him is that he didn't take himself too seriously. He was so self-deprecating, and that was true about him for the rest of his life. He was so self-deprecating. But at the same time, like, clearly liked attention and was good at marshaling it.
So we alluded to checks and prostitutes. Is this the incident that ushered him out of politics?
No.
The first time.
Another common misconception that Jerry lost his position in politics because of this sex scandal, which I'll describe in a second, and was, you know, turned to trash TV. But in fact, it was not so simple. It was that, and in fact, it's a better story. He was indeed exposed as having visited a brothel in Kentucky, just a few minutes away from Cincinnati, and paid for the services of a prostitute with a personal check that he signed. And this came out in the newspaper, in the Cincinnati Inquirer, sort of. It came out first. It came out as a blind item on the front page of the Cincinnati Inquirer that local politician.
You got really into the Cincinnati Inquirer and the Cincinnati Post, the press, the press machinations of the time. I learned a lot about what was going on in the press and in the Post and the Inquirer back then.
Yeah, no, I love that storyline. I mean, so the Inquirer was sort of associated with the old guard, kind of conservative establishment in the city, and they ran this weird item on the front page by a columnist saying, like, a local Cincinnati politician, maybe they said Democrat, I'm not going to tell you who, got in trouble for so and so. And that obviously set off a feeding frenzy of everyone trying to figure out who it was. We talked to the reporter from the Cincinnati Post, Carol Sanger, who ended up breaking the story the following day that it was Jerry Springer. And the behind the scenes of it all, and which Carol ended up writing about like later, was that basically this rumor about Jerry had made its way to the desk of a local prosecutor, Simon Lease, and Cy Lease, and I can tell the story without much equivocation because I got it directly from him. He's about, I think, 90 years old now, and we called him up and he told us the story with total candor.
He loved being a prosecutor.
He was like a tough Law and Order, old school, kind of biblical guy. He hated Jerry Springer's politics, as he told me. He said, look, that guy was a radical. I didn't like where he was taking the city. And this, you know, I got this rumor. One of my DAs in my office, ADAs in my office, told me about this. And I said, you know, let's use that to get him out of office. And so he went to the head of the Democratic Party and basically threatened to expose Springer if he didn't resign. And Springer did. He resigned. According to Carol, he was packing his boxes. He and his wife were packing their boxes to leave town under threat of this. I don't know if you call it extortion attempt, but, and then the story of course came out and everyone found out it was Jerry, and he kind of took the position, the posture he assumed was one of regret, of course, but also transparency. He didn't hide from it. And I think people ultimately appreciated that he didn't try to talk around it.
Engaged in activities, which at least to me are questionable. These actions have weighed heavily on my conscience. And early last week, I contacted the FBI and voluntarily answered all inquiries of what I had done and of what I had knowledge. I am continuing to cooperate in that investigation in any way that I can.
And ultimately, after I think it was about a year in the wilderness, maybe less even, he ran again for city council. The Democrats wouldn't take him. Interestingly, we didn't get into this, but the Democrats didn't, or maybe we did. The Democrats didn't want him because they thought he was still radioactive. So he ran as an independent, won his seat back, got by far more, you know, I think way more votes than he'd gotten before the scandal, and ultimately became mayor. It was tawdry. It's tawdry, but also the fact that he paid for it with a personal check, I think, cut the sting a little bit, if that's the right expression. It like made him look like an oaf rather than a perv. And so those women at the bowling alley were like, yeah.
But definitely a weirdo either way. What was Carol's reaction to all of this, as far as you could tell?
I think she, in particular, felt like it was someone with great promise having squandered it. She thought that, and I think everyone, you know, around him, actually, I can't speak to this definitively, but I think a lot of people assumed he was done after this scandal. And people saw it as like a bit of a tragedy, I think, that he had been bounced out of a promising future. And I think they were, I don't know. I'd be speculating, but I think there was some anger to it, which I, you know, at him for making this decision, for making the stupid decision. But I also think I'm mentioning that only because I think there's an echo in how people felt about the scandal, about the prostitution scandal, with how a lot of these folks ended up feeling about his television show. I think people in Cincinnati want to pretend the show never happened because they want to remember Jerry as the statesman, the guy that they all rallied around. And I think the show is sort of hard for them to accommodate.
We'll be back in a minute with more of Leon Neyfakh talking about his Jerry Springer podcast. We return now to talk about Jerry Springer as the crowd takes the call of Jerry, as I speak with Leon Neyfakh.
Ladies and gentlemen, would you please welcome the eighth wonder of the world, Jerry Springer.
Was there an interregnum period where it was he was trying to have his cake and eat it too, or sometimes it was serious and then sometimes it did the toe touch of the circus, or was there one day or from one season to the next we went from the public-minded civics affairs to I'm having an affair with my dog?
Right. Unfortunately, it's not like a clean fault line of, you know, dividing before and after. It was, you know, a lot of people credit Jerry, a producer who worked under Jerry, named Richard Dominic, who was eventually, you know, who had come from the world of tabloids and who had a taste for vulgarity and humor. You know, he was someone who loved writing funny articles I forget the name, which tabloid he worked for, but there's some great clips of him on Letterman.
But it's not intended as a goof, is it?
Oh, no, they're true stories.
And you take it seriously?
Oh, sure.
And you, not only do you write the headlines, you also do some reporting, as we mentioned.
Right, sure. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's just go through some of these newspapers, and you tell me about them, and we'll see what we can learn from these. All right, this first one right here, it's an article about John Wayne. Clips off of there. Doctors are stunned as baby speaks and reveals, "I'm John Wayne." Right there.
That's it, yeah.
There it is. A three-month-old baby. There's the baby. Shocked the world by revealing in a loud, let me see the rest of it, clear voice, "I'm John Wayne." All right. Now, this is not true.
Oh, yes, it is.
This is true.
In fact, I've met the baby.
You met the baby. Where was the child born?
The child was born in England, outside of Manchester. Right.
You traveled to Manchester.
Yes.
Visited with the baby. Months old, the baby speaks.
Yes. When I saw the baby, it was about 3.5 months.
Mm-hmm. And what did the baby say?
The baby spoke in John Wayne's voice. Baby asked if I saw True Grit.
Now you're kidding about this,
no,
aren't you?
No.
The baby said, "I'm John Wayne.
I'm John Wayne.
Did you see True Grit?" A 3-month-old baby.
Yes, did you see True Grit? Did you think I deserved the Oscar? Was the exact thing the baby said.
Anyway, he took that sensibility, that kind of tabloid sensibility, and booked segments, you know, in service of it. And those segments did well. And eventually he was promoted to executive producer. And it's, you know, generally believed that, like, with his, it was under his influence that the show became increasingly, you know, centered on conflict and kind of absurd revelations and secrets and betrayals. But, you know, Jerry was along for the ride. I think you can't, this is a big debate about Jerry, like, how much of the blame does he deserve for the show, or was it just the people around him? But, like, my feeling is that his name is in the title. And so there's a limit to how much distance he could put between himself and it.
But also, he did in his public explanation of this wasn't that's, well, he would say, I'm a guy named Jerry Springer, and there was a show called The Jerry Springer Show, but it's like thinking about a bus driver and a Christian. I mean, you could be a Christian and a bus driver. It doesn't mean that your bus driving has any impact on your Christianity or what you are in your personal life. But, and this was my favorite episode, when he gets called in front of the Chicago City Council. He had a different line of reasoning, which was more like, it's lighthearted, you're taking it too seriously. And I do think he turned it around on the snobs of the, or the overly serious people who were coming off as too prosecutorial for what was essentially a source of entertainment.
Yeah, he would take different tacks depending on who he was talking to and who was attacking him. Sometimes he would say, you're taking it too seriously, this is just a fun, stupid show. He used the phrase, it's just chewing gum, which I love. I guess that's a saying. But he's just chewing gum. The quote I like was like, the world will survive it, and the world would have survived without it, and it'll survive with it. And then other times he would actually offer like an affirmative defense of it, and he would talk about how the snobs who would criticize it, you know, think it's disgusting to have poor ordinary Americans, you know, who live in trailer parks talking about their private lives and talking about sex and you know, personal or, you know, domestic strife. But when Princess Diana does it, when the rich and famous do it, we treat it as news. We treat it as something that we should all be paying attention to, and they're allowed to do it. Why shouldn't my people be allowed to do it? Why should my people not be allowed to go on TV? And I think, you know, you can detect like a bit of his the populism that I think he also wanted to embody.
Yeah, he was a genuine populist, so he wasn't lying when he said that. But he was also clearly searching for ways to either launder or legitimize what he was doing, which indicates that he did not think, even though he was getting paid a tremendous amount of money, he felt he had to do that. Sometimes he was called in front of a council, but in general, he was driven to talk about the show in ways that made the show seem different or grander, or put it in a different context than the show clearly was. And that is, what do you think was going on there psychologically? Because there's one interpretation, he never took his eye off politics. So maybe you could say, oh, he always wanted to have the ability to use that as a legitimate launching point. But do you think something else was going on psychologically that he couldn't just say, yeah, it's circus, I'm the circus master, leave me alone?
But he did say that sometimes, you know? And so, like, I do think it depends on where he was in his life, like what mood he was in when you caught him with a question. I think one thing that he never reckoned with, at least not that I ever saw, was that, yes, like, he, as the host, is not being mean to his guests. He is being very respectful of them as he asks these questions from the audience. You know, he sort of usually stands among the audience members with his microphone. And he kind of puts the ball in play with a couple of basic questions, and then all hell breaks loose. And he kind of plays the, like, befuddled, exasperated uncle who is trying to get everyone to be reasonable and, like, be honest about their feelings and find some path forward. And, you know, the final thoughts are sort of like the apotheosis of that, where he's like pretending like this was all in service of some moral lesson. Don't let this happen to you, kind of thing. What gives the lie to that, I think, or description of the show, is that, like, the audience that he's standing in the middle of the whole time is cheering for these people to embarrass themselves, to beat each other up. They're chanting Jerry's name sort of as a war cry to be like, we want you to fight each other.
Right. He'd put the microphone, he'd say, you have a question, and then the audience members would just horribly insult the guests.
Horribly. Yes. Yeah, like so, so, so mean.
Huge rounds of applause.
Hey, this question's for Devin. Hey, man, when are you going to stop picking up women at the zoo? You got a giraffe and two rhinos here. What's up?
My comment is for Pillsbury Dope Boy in the Red. Maybe you need to give her a try. She can help you slim out a little bit.
I just want to know, do any of you women have any self-respect at all? Man, you shouldn't even be with.
I have a question for the two ladies in the pool. Is that what sperm whales look like?
This goes out to my man in the pool swimming with and Honey Boo Boo. Just because you size women didn't mean you had to get two of them.
Yeah, this is for Chisel Face. What god chiseled your face? Loki the trickster?
I got a comment for the Walmart version of K. Michelle in the black dress over there. You forgetting knee pads at home, sweetie?
My question was for Felicia. Felicia, I could kind of tell you want to wear the pants in the relationship. My question was, you think they were going to fit?
It does remind me, and I want to make the leaper analogy to another reality show, reminds me of the wrestling announcer, Mean Gene Okerlund, who is supposedly not part of the chaos, but he's a character, and without him, the whole chaos wouldn't operate exactly as it did.
Yeah, and so like, Jerry knew that that was what his show was, that like the spirit in which people were watching it was primarily to ridicule these people and to feel superior to them. So like, he's a smart guy. Like he knew, I think, that there was a limit to how, to what he could do laundering it wise. And I think that's why he fluctuated. Like sometimes he thought he could pull off like making the affirmative case for, oh, this is about representation and, you know, there are like queer theory papers about how like this was the first time that anyone in, you know, middle America saw a trans person on TV. And, you know, even though they called her a tranny and ridiculed her and pulled her wig off, it was still a net benefit that like this was to some extent normalized by having, you know, people like this on TV. So I think the case for Jerry Springer as like a for the Jerry Springer show, I should say, as like a vector for progress is strained.
So at the time, it was really widely decried, and not just by the Daughters of the American Revolution type blue noses. It was really widely decried as the worst thing on television slash in our society. And maybe there were some people like John Waters who found it campy or not so bad, but this was a consensus opinion in a way that I think today in retrospect, nothing has that amount of opprobrium, right? I mean, Real Housewives, many episodes is much worse, and you'll not even get a fraction of the criticism of that show that Jerry Springer got. Why do you think that was?
Well, for one thing, it was genuinely shocking. Like, and I kind of assumed that I'm a, you know, seasoned consumer of vulgar and profane, obscene content. And
sure,
I'm sure 20 years, you know, 20, 30 years on, this is going to seem quaint. And it doesn't. Like a lot of it is genuinely shocking to the senses, if not to like the moral core.
What shocked you? Name an episode or a moment that shocked you.
You're putting me on the spot here, but I guess I don't want to be lame and reference the sort of consensus pick of, you know, the most outrageous the Jerry Springer show ever got, but like it has that reputation for a reason. I Married a Horse. We spend quite a bit of time on it in the series.
So you actually had a ceremony where you married this horse?
Yes.
You live with this horse?
Yes.
And sure, you are having intimate relations with this horse?
Yeah. That's true.
This is pretty sick, isn't it?
But it's what it sounds like. It's about a guy who said he was in a consensual relationship with a pony, a Shetland pony. And it's like, sounds funny. And you kind of, they used the word married critically and not like something else that they could have said, because as it describes in great detail and quite vivid detail in this segment, he had sex with the horse. Like he was raping this horse, and he describes like he kisses the horse on television with tongue like many, many, many times. And it's
did you in your series in 2025, did you have to say we can't air this on
non-broadcast? I mean, it helps that it's audio, but but you can hear the kissing very vividly. The other thing I'll say is you watch it maybe with a little bit of insight all these years later, because you realize that, like, and I don't want to slander anyone here. I'm not making a generalization about everyone who was on the show, but like clearly a lot of these people were dealing with all kinds of really serious problems. I mean, drug addiction, desperate circumstances that led them to be sex workers, and that they, you know, reluctantly. I mean, we know more sort of about how people, I think, get and end up having problems like the kind that Jerry Springer spotlighted, and they don't really talk about drugs in the show. They almost never let that be part of the plot, interestingly. But like, I don't know, there's just like a darkness to it, and if you let your imagination kind of like fill in the blanks of like what these people's lives were probably like back home, it's just hard to not be astonished that like the way that's being presented is like for a laugh, and for like an unkind laugh, I should say, because the audience in the studio, like, they are not laughing with these people for most of the time. They're laughing at them.
Yeah, I think back then the valence of the criticism was, you're dragging our society towards a place that we don't want, and you're corrupting the youth, something like that. Now, I think it would be more shocking based on cruelty. There's a cruelness to it. And that wasn't the main thrust of the critique back in the 90s.
I would agree with that. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the fighting, I suppose, is like a stand-in for, you know, it's gross to watch people tear each other apart. But yeah, like, I think Jerry was right that there was a tinge to some of the criticism of like, ugh, like, we don't want to look at these people. Like, these people should not be on TV. Like, there was some of that, I think.
Yeah.
But at least watching it now, I think the thing that jumped out at us was, yeah, like, Jerry standing by and letting this cruelty unfold and getting to sort of like wash his hands of it by reading off a kind of canned final thought about how we should all treat each other with respect.
And what is the big unanswered question for Jerry?
Why didn't you quit the show? Is when I would ask him, like, did you have opportunities to walk away and you chose not to? Like, how did you decide that? Were you aware of the trade-offs you were accepting when you took this detour that turned into the rest of your life? I think I would ask him, did you feel guilty for your show? Like, because again, like, he fluctuated so much between being kind of neutral on it and being dismissive of it. But like, what's the truth? Did you go to your grave thinking that you had done something that made the world a more violent, less, you know, an uglier place? Do you think do you wish it hadn't happened? I guess that's one question I would want to ask him.
Leon Neyfakh is the impresario behind the Fiasco series. Check that out wherever you check out podcasts. And his latest for Audible Originals, which I'm telling you, they are now admitting our podcast. They have a little bar that says podcast, and you can find it right there. That is Final Thoughts. It's all about Jerry Springer. Leon, thank you so much.
Thanks, Mike. Great to talk to you.
And that's it for today's show. I want you to be good to yourself and each other on the July 4th holiday, when we will be taking off. Who are we? We are the consortium of Corey Wara, Ashley Kahn, Astrid Green, Michelle Pesca, Leo Baum, and Kathleen Sykes. Together, united in a state of, if not America, then just listing, podcasting, and celebrating all that is our country. Umpuruji puru du puru, and thanks for listening.